The following podcast is a production of Desray Media. Pew pew.
Space saboteurs seize control of Earthmen's minds by radio thought waves. The Earth Rocket Commando surprise space invaders on the moon.
Welcome, members of the Death Ray Squadron. It is Trent. This week, we've got, well, we're pulling back from the archive again from 2016, a panel I was on at the Salt Lake Comic Con. This was a panel that we did on the history of 70s comic books. So this is the birth of the Golden Age, my favorite age of comic books. You'll hear some familiar names and voices who have been on some of the other panels that we've put up as podcasts. Coming up, though, is the Salt Lake Comic Con 2017 edition. That's going to be November 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. If you haven't got your tickets yet, you can do so at saltlakecomiccon.com. I've only got a couple of these panels that I've recorded from the 2016 Comic Con left, and in the future, we're going to be publishing a bunch of interviews that I've been doing. Some really cool stuff. I'm excited to kind of dive into this new realm of speaking with comic book creators and just learning about their lives. For me, that's always been the greatest part of comic book podcasts is when I can, you know, I love hearing about what they're doing, but I want to know their secret origin stories. Like when we heard from Steve Lieber, that was amazing. I mean, granted, not everyone could be Steve Lieber. That said, let's get into this episode, the history of 70s comics.
Hey everybody, welcome to Comics of the 70s.
History of comics.
Woo! Woot.
Half of you are like, woo, half of you are like, this isn't a writer's conference. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming here, Salt Lake Comic Con, once again. I am very humbled to be here with this amazing panel of people. I am, of course, Chris Hoffman. I am the writer-creator of the Salt City Strangers, Utah's most awesomest superheroes. Been lucky enough to moderate the, yeah, see? Thank you, Mom.
Woo!
But the random strangers. But so I want to get through the introductions.
Wait,
real quick here.
But where are you guys located on Artist Alley?
What was that?
White 28.
There oh, you thank go. You. Yes. Yeah. See? The businessman up on the corner here. White 28 on the Artist Alley. Stop by, say hi, get a copy of the books here. To my right is my esteemed colleague, Josh Butterfield. Josh, tell the Hold folks on. About you.
I brought these so I could whip them off dramatically.
Yeah, oh.
Josh Butterfield. Indie comic book writer, game designer, and podcaster extraordinaire.
I'm Andrew Malin of Dr. Volt's Comics. I also lecture comic history at Salt Lake Community College.
And I'm Trent Hunsaker, writer and podcaster in the house that Kevin Smith built, Smodcast.com.
What these three guys also didn't mention is that they are walking, talking encyclopedias. So when we're talking about comic books in the 70s, it's going to be hard-pressed to find information that these guys... Oh, yeah, Josh. That those two guys don't.
These two guys,
you know what I mean? We'll go with the easy side of this. This is going to be like flipping through an encyclopedia, starting it through A through Z. So we've got some information that we want to put out, but, you know... Put up your hand, ask questions. We love interaction on this. So,
and there is a mic.
There is a mic.
Is it on?
I don't know. We'll find out.
Is it on? So I want to talk about comics in the 70s. Do you guys want to start out with just a quick, like, what was your favorite comic in the 70s?
Oh, man.
I love Tomb of Dracula and Howard Ooh. The Duck.
Yeah.
That were strangely related. Because Gene Colan worked on both books. Yeah.
Right on. Trent?
I'm a huge Roy Thomas fan. The 70s are like so great because you had all these fanboys now making comics and like doing what they always wanted to do with the characters that we love. But at the end of the day, I got to go with Steve Englehart's Defenders.
Cool. Oh, yeah. Perfect.
Yeah.
my favorite thing about the 70s is that for comics, it was no longer the 60s, and all that old guard crap that was the Silver Age of comics was slowly dying and being replaced with people that kind of spoke our language. But my favorite comic that started in the 70s was actually Cerebus, and I'll tell you why shortly. Nice. Cool. I brought it. It's a prop, but it's a real book.
It's a deep track.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So, interesting. Andrew, I think you probably want to take this subject here. First slide in our image here. You were telling me a very interesting story in the 70s that the Punisher and the movie First Blood, which was actually retitled later, Rambo First Blood, because Rambo used to be First Blood Part 2.
Yeah, that's right. Right.
Yep.
So, yeah, tell us a little bit. Tell the fine folks this story you were telling me about.
So, we all know Rambo is this disgruntled, PTSD-ridden Vietnam vet, right? And so the book, First Blood, Part 2, is the movie they based is based on the book, First Blood, Part 2. And Punisher is based on the same character. He's based on John Rambo from the books. And they...
kicked ass and took names?
No, sorry. It just petered out after the Bernie Wrightson panel yesterday. Yeah. The Punisher's first stories, he was dealing with other disgruntled Vietnam vets that were looking to assassinate public figures. Mm. And so the first guys he was hunting besides Spider-Man were other Vietnam vets that were similarly deranged.
But he did it in style with white go-go boots.
Yeah. White go-go boots and a big van with a skull on the side. Because that's...
Nothing cooler in the 70s than a van, dude.
Yeah, exactly.
Undercover with Punisher.
Yeah.
Who is that guy?
So, like you were saying, Trent, you were saying on this one, like, there's a difference between, like, heroes that came out in the Golden Age. So, the veterans that were coming home from the war and what sort of heroes those were. What was the difference in the heroes that came out in the 70s?
Yeah, this is where we see, I mean, aside from Submariner, the birth of the anti-hero, right? We no longer have, with Vietnam going on, we no longer have this good and bad, right and wrong, black and white. And so we see a lot of characters develop that are ambiguous as to where they're aligned, whether, Deathstroke, same thing. Like, these characters... that they're doing it for money. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting that it was seen as kind of this gray area pre-80s where everything was so monetarily driven, which I think was almost a precursor to what was, coming.
Mm-hmm. Also, good guys doing the right thing for the wrong reasons or doing the wrong thing for the right reasons became prevalent because... And I'm sure we're going to talk about this, but the comics code kind of was lifted quite a bit in the 70s. It was kind of the beginning of the end for that. And so,
people familiar with what the comics code was? Raise of hands who've never heard of the comics code.
Okay, good.
Okay, so a quick thing. One of our encyclopedias. Give them the Reader's Digest version.
Okay, comics code was a self-governing body of... It was like nuns and judges and
librarians
and other people of high moral authority. They would submit in New York, and they would submit the comics for approval to get that government stamp of approval, the comic code authority that this comic has been approved. And if you didn't get that stamp, they wouldn't sell the comics at the newsstands.
Yeah, and this is what's so interesting about the 70s is this was the creation of the direct market as well, to where you could publish something that didn't have that stamp of approval. The stamp of approval came because the comic industry thought that if we didn't police ourselves for some moral bar to reach, then the government's going to do it for us. And so this was a preemptive way to hopefully have some integrity without having giving up complete control to the government.
But it failed.
Yeah. So miserably. What was the thing about the comics code that was lifted in the 70s?
They became more lenient with horror comics. You could have vampires and werewolves and Frankensteins.
Mm-hmm. And drug use.
And violence. No, they still...
No drug use.
They had
no drug use.
right?
There was actually, in the 70s, they had a Spider-Man comic that they had to run three issues without the code stamp of approval because it was a drug story. Harry Osborn had gotten hooked on pills.
It's so weird to read.
Like
right, and it's that great Gil Kane floney head art.
No, wait a minute. Wasn't the Speedy on heroin, wasn't that in the 70s?
That's also 70s.
Yep. Neil Adams. Yep.
But
I go back to my drug use on the 70s.
They got permission to do that one. That one is code approved.
Yes.
Yeah, because it was an anti-drug story. This one was also anti-drug, but less, it was more subtle than that. Believe it or not, Stan Lee was being subtle when he wrote it.
Wow.
Yeah. Not a man known for his subtlety.
So, another product of the 70s here. Two products of the 70s. Thanos and Darkseid, right? So, I want to take a quick poll here. Did Darkseid come first? Hands up. Did Thanos come first? Hands up.
Well, and a lot of people abstaining, apparently.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah.
And some people are like,
who doesn't know who Thanos and Darkseid are?
And the third option, Mongol. Does people want to weigh in on Mongol? Yeah. No. One person knows who Mongol is. Thank you.
One person who's listened to you a lot talk about it, I'm sure.
I'm dying to know.
So who came first? Darkseid came first. And Jim Starlin said in an interview about Adam Warlock and Thanos that he loved the idea of the new gods so much he wanted to do his own, even though Kirby would later go on and do the Eternals, which are essentially the new gods of Marvel.
Marvel's universe.
But he wanted to do his own pantheon of new gods of Titan. They were the Titans. And when they first appeared, Thanos and his brother and his father all had purple skin like him. And they went on and made Thanos look more different, so he would be a mutant eternal.
Speaking of the purple skin, I want people to notice in this picture of Thanos, he's the guy on my right. If that's the skin tone, that means he's kind of wearing underwear. That's a little banana hammock right there, because those his legs don't have any pants on them at all.
A men's European swimsuit.
Yes.
Well, Darkseid of that era wore a breezy short skirt.
You know what? He was in a skirt.
When you're trying to dominate the world, you have to be
universe.
This was also the introduction of the thong in the comic book world. You can't see it. There's a little. Never mind. Carry on.
Not comic code approved.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and then one of the greatest superheroes to come out of comics came out of the 70s. Our good friend, the Wolverine, the world's greatest Canadian hero. Right. So, Josh, do you know what the original idea behind Wolverine was? I'm putting you kind of on the spot here. I know those two. This is an easy question for that. But do you know what the original origin, comic book origin of Wolverine was?
Yes.
Done. Yep.
Hold on.
He sets it down lightly instead of dropping it.
Be polite to the audio.
Oh, I just cringed.
I have no idea, Chris. I don't know.
So, Trent, fill everybody
in. Yeah, so Lane Wynn created Wolverine, and when he did it, he created a character who had gloves that had claws that came out of his gloves, not in his hands.
Right.
They were meant to be gloves.
Right.
Yeah.
And to add on to that, he also had commented at a different time, the claws were always meant to be in the gloves, but that he was a Wolverine that got turned into a person.
Yeah, that had been mutated
into
a person.
Yeah, he was a Wolverine that got hyper-evolved into a tiny man.
Or a big Wolverine.
Big Wolverine.
I've read this twice. And Len Wein said in a Marvel masterpiece that that's what happened, but the death of Wolverine, he's the guy interviewed in the back. He disavowed that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, that's his prerogative.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going off of what I remember reading, what he said back in every time up until the death of Wolverine.
Yeah.
So it's his prerogative to change his story, but he's wrong.
But they've also changed the origin story of Wolverine over 1,000 times. So, yeah. I mean, who's surprised that they changed the ultimate genesis of the character?
Yeah.
Right.
So the 70s was also a genesis for a lot of amazing characters, not just the Wolverine, but there was a lot of stuff going on here. So we have a slide here of a A lot of Marvel. There was a lot of Marvel creation, like not as many DC characters. There was a lot of the DC characters were already around in the 60s, right? So I don't know if you guys can see this from here. We have Luke Cage, Iron Fist, Spider-Woman, giant-sized X-Men, which...
Just the new team. Yeah.
Which is the new team and ushered in. Wasn't that like the official like Bronze Age change in was when giant X-Men came out, 74?
Sure.
Yeah, we can say that. It was, what, 74?
Yeah.
Yeah, so. And then, yeah, sure, you're right.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then Howard the Duck, Ghost Rider, Moon Knight, and Tomb of Dracula. So what was it unique about these characters that they had to have come out in the 70s and they didn't come out earlier or later?
More minorities and also female characters.
And ducks.
And ducks.
Yeah, definitely ducks.
Which I would describe as a minority.
Yeah.
And again, the anti-hero as well. You've got people who are doing things, for, you know, good things, but also with incentive involved.
Yeah, the Tomb of Dracula book follows the villain. Dracula is not the hero of that comic. The hero is the Night Stalkers, which is Frank Drake and Quincy Harker and the guys that are trying to hunt him down. But it was unique in the 70s that you could have a villain-focused book. DC did it with Joker also. In the 70s.
That's right.
And it was hard to follow him as a hero.
Yeah.
Especially in that era when he was
Before. When he was more of a slapstick character as opposed to the dark, brooding maniac.
Yeah.
So I'm actually interested. I wanted to ask some questions about Luke Cage because he's got his new TV show coming out, right?
Isn't it the end of the month?
Yeah. Everybody excited for that?
Woo! Christmas.
It was supposed to come out in June, but whatever.
Yeah.
I wasn't waiting.
Right. So what about his origin and his creation was special about superheroes in the 70s?
So you've got someone who was, you had a real life villain, right? Someone who had committed a crime, had gone to prison, and was, thinking about it now, I'm just like, oh man, this is Tuskegee all over again. Yeah. You know what I mean? But who was experimented on by the government and then got his powers from that.
Who was he created by?
Oh, gosh.
Do you know off the top of your head?
I don't know.
Why are you doing this?
I know, because I was like, I literally thought I was just going to come in. These guys will know everything. That's all good.
I don't.
Bill S. Preston Esquire or Ted Theodore Logan?
Okay, so what was important about, I know Andrew actually told me about this beforehand. So what was important about like the new team of the X-Men coming out in giant-size X-Men?
Oh, so up until this point, the X-Men book had been canceled. And they weren't doing new issues. They were just reprinting the old 60s issues. And until Giant Size came out, it was just a dead book. And they had an international team. This was a United Nations of Mutants. And it was very experimental. And it was Len Wein, right?
Yep.
Len Wein and Dave Cockrum that did it. And if you can get your hands on a Dave Cockrum sketchbook, there are some great preliminary sketches for the characters like Storm and Nightcrawler the original Nightcrawler designs, much more devil-like.
Yeah.
Yeah, horns and everything.
Yeah, where more to where we see what his father looks like now.
Yeah, exactly. He looks like Azazel.
Yep.
And so this team was significant because this was also one of the first teams that had an African-American leader that was also a female. I mean, it was a big deal that they broke some ground with Giant Size X-Men.
Sure. And then how about Moon Knight or Ghost Rider? Moon Knight was basically like Marvel's attempt at a Batman, right?
Right.
Yeah, did they introduce it that he was Jewish in this one? No.
Not at first.
Not at first.
No.
But he was a Jewish mercenary that got powers from an Egyptian god.
Right. Mm-hmm.
As a Jew, I think that's a little strange, but
this is also a good example of a character who can look great and be poorly written and ultimately fail miserably.
Or he keeps getting these fantastic creative teams, but I get four issues in and I'm like, I'm reading Moon Knight, what happened? You know? So,
cool.
Yep.
All right, well, let's switch gears over to DC. Oh, I'm sorry.
One thing I've always liked about the 70s was art. Was there some change, especially in Marvel?
Absolutely.
Because it's like the 50s and 60s, the characters look kind of flat.
Right.
Well, that also depends on the artist. I mean, you look at the more old-fashioned kind of artists, the guys that were working it in the 40s and 50s that are, then they carried over to the 60s. But the new blood, the guys that came in the 60s, kind of had that new style. They looked more towards like Will Eisner for inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they'd grown up reading Kirby and Eisner.
And they'd come from a more like commercial art background. And they added a lot more sensibilities. Like one of the new kids on the block in the 60s was Steranko. Mm-hmm. And he influenced a lot of guys. And the in the 70s, you had guys that grew up with comics. Yep.
Neil Adams, right? I mean, are you talking about Neil Adams and the contribution he had to the art?
Yeah, in the 60s, he was a huge influence on everybody that came after him. And if you look at big guys from the 70s, like Kaluta and Wrightson, who's here, you can meet Bernie Wrightson here, one of the huge breakout guys in the 70s, they grew up reading the 50s comics and brought a, it was kind of a mixture of this 60s aesthetic, this new 60s aesthetic that like Steranko and Adams had, but mixed with this great horror influence.
Yeah.
The, one of the, I'm trying to think. Sorry. Keep Josh, going. I'll come
Josh,
back.
Josh, did you have something? You were going to.
Oh, no, no. It's, you, no.
Oh, no.
That's
was,
it. Yeah.
Josh.
Oh, Josh.
Bill S. Preston Esquire or Ted Theodore Logan?
No, I was going to say
Wild Stallions.
I think what you get, I agree with you. Like the cover of Hero for Hire and Spider Woman here, that's kind of what I expect comic books to look like. This is, if I think of comic books in the back of my head, those are the, that's the style. That's the T-shirts you see at Target, and that's the all the source material that people are going back to now for the new TV shows,
yeah,
movies, and whatnot.
It's definitely the you know when the oversized muscles and other body parts kind of became the expectation, right? Where it was, let's see how tight we can draw this costume.
Right.
As opposed to
how do you stand like that cover, like, oh, this hurts, you know what I mean?
Right.
How do you stand in those poses for more? That's exactly what I think of.
But yeah, I mean, and like Andrew was saying, that's a direct influence from, you know, from your growing up reading Eisner and Kirby.
Gotcha. Ready for DC?
Yes.
What DC had for us here. So you were mentioning Swamp Thing and House of Secrets, right, Andrew?
Oh, yeah. Take yeah, away. So who came first? Swamp Thing, Man Thing?
Who thinks Swamp Thing?
Yeah, raise your hand for Swamp Thing.
Who thinks Man Thing?
Yeah, the answer is The Heap. He came first, and he's from the 40s.
Who said that? Was that you?
Yeah.
The Heap?
Wow. Yeah.
Come up to the panel. Yeah, man. You know your stuff.
Now, Heap came first, and they were all influenced by It, by Theodore Sturgeon, which was, he was like, it was like the first swamp monster in fiction. So.
Cool. Yeah. And like I said, this is a lot fewer of like the huge names that came out of the 70s in DC, but you have Power Girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who had a much more modest costume in the 70s. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Black Lightning. You said Ra's al Ghul was a huge...
Ra's al Ghul was one of the big guys that came out of the 70s.
Who came up with him?
That was Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams.
Back then it
was Ra's. Ra's. Yeah.
But, and talk about a great creative team during the 70s, too.
Yeah, those guys were great.
Or Firestorm. So this is a different Firestorm than the... Is this a different character you were saying that's...
Well, the Firestorm that's on the TV show that a lot of people would be familiar with is based on the newer Firestorm. The New 52 Firestorm.
Yeah, Gail Simone.
Yeah,
the Gail Firestorm. Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha.
So you can see up here, you look, Kirby was a big deal at DC in the 70s with New Gods and the Demon and Sandman and Kamandi.
Yeah.
And
Miracle Man.
Miracle Man, all the Fourth World stuff. And the Fourth World started where? In Jimmy Olsen.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't really happen.
Yeah, he took over Jimmy. They, DC wooed Kirby over to their offices.
Yeah.
Because Kirby was sick of being treated like he got treated his entire life, sadly. And he created a whole new universe for DC, and DC likes to brag that they paid Kirby more for the fourth world than he got paid for creating the Marvel Universe.
It's, and sadly, it wasn't. They were never really great selling books, partially because it wasn't this new style, right?
Yeah.
So
a lot of collage.
Yeah, if you had a lot of young readers coming in and they would see kind of this chunky, flat style, and they wanted to see something, more like giant size X-Men. And it didn't sell. They didn't know the history behind it. They didn't, know where he came from. And I think a lot of people will more gravitate towards that Kirby stuff once they have learned kind of where it came from and appreciate it a little bit more that way.
Yeah, I know. I got into Kirby as a teenager, but as a kid, I used to think the art looked old-fashioned.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah.
The Ditko, also a big creator over at Marvel, came over to DC due to financial disagreements with Marvel over Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And so Ditko created a lot of characters in the 70s for DC with Shade the Changing Man The Creeper. Those were big, also not big sellers.
Right.
Yeah. And these, but they're these amazing talents and they're starting to go back to them. And they're, comic creators will always go back to these very innovative and original style characters.
Gotcha. So I also want to remind that we do have this mic up here, or if you want to hang out and ask a question, just raise your hand. We've love to answer questions here. Another phenomenon.
Oh. Jason's got one.
I do.
Okay.
Kirby's original plan was not to draw and write. Can you talk a little bit about, if you know, what his plan was for that?
For
the fourth world.
He wanted to be a stuntman in... wrong Kirby. Wrong Kirby. Go ahead, guys. This is a comic question.
I don't know.
No, I've
not heard that.
His original plan was to be the editor.
But he was the editor also.
Right.
Yeah. But they literally let him do whatever he wanted. Yeah.
He was just going to plot it out.
I hadn't heard that.
Others to write and draw. That was... why part of what hurt him with DC was they were working him so hard.
Yeah. I mean, at the time he was doing, gosh,
it was four books a month
at least. Yeah. I think. Yeah. Like, Yeah. Aside from doing layouts or on other stuff too during that. Yeah.
You're always planning on having Ditko and Wally Wood.
Yes. Wood. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Wally Wood's another one of those great talents that they snapped up in the 70s. He was really big in the 50s and the 60s. I mean, he's responsible for redesigning Daredevil's costume from that horrendous-looking gym suit into the Red Devil suit.
Well, I mean, Daredevil didn't know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's like, it looks good to me.
Come on, like...
They missed an awesome chance in the TV show when he first got the costume. I so wanted it to be yellow and have Foggy look at it and go, no. Yeah. And then the next scene, it's red.
Yeah. I mean, you can't blame him.
Yeah.
I'm just happy that it was, somewhat uniform. Like, colors matched.
Yeah.
I'm impressed, really. Yeah. You could sort that out. Sorry.
Another phenomenon in the 70s was the rise of... music bands getting their own comic book.
Yes.
So we had the Alice Cooper. This one, do you know much about the Kiss comic?
I know that they first appeared in Howard the Duck. A girl was possessed by the devil, and when the son of Satan was cast the demon out of her, it coalesced into the band Kiss.
The true origin story of Kiss, by the way. I hope someone's taking notes.
And then Kiss had their big super special, and it's not actually the one we've got pictured there, but the one, I think we actually have one at the Volts booth, if we've got any big Kiss fans here. They put their blood into the printer's ink.
Oh, jeez.
Because that's how metal a band they were.
I verified this by licking those comics, and it is, in fact, blood.
And remind you... 70s metal, folks.
Yeah, like, 70s metal. So it's pretty light.
This is no Mastodon we're talking about here, okay?
Yeah, and so if you can get your hands on one of those, you can clone your very own Gene Simmons.
Nice.
Yeah, except for you have Paul Stanley's head.
I remember from this, they actually had superpowers.
Yes.
Like the demon could breathe fire.
Yeah, that's right.
So.
And a really long tongue. It's true.
Right. So, but there were a lot of indie comics came out in the 70s, too. Not to be remiss, it was a lot harder back in the day to actually get a comic book printed. Nowadays, you know, we make the strangers because we have desktop publishing tools and whatnot, but making an indie... Oh, I'm sorry.
Just before we move away from the music stuff,
yeah.
There was... I mean, record sales were crazy at this time, right?
Disco.
Yeah, you finally had these rock arenas, you know what I mean? So there was great marketing opportunities to merchandise this stuff. I think it's worth at least addressing that the 80s character Dazzler was incepted in the Bronze Age.
Yeah, tell us about that, because I've heard this story. So
yeah, so essentially...
Tell people.
There was
does everybody know who Dazzler is? Okay.
Okay, so Dazzler...
Roller skates on a superhero.
Yeah, so you've got Dazzler, who is a disco singer who has the ability to... project energy out of sound, right? And it all the creation of the character via committee,
yeah,
came out of a record label wanting to like merchandise something with the comic book. So they came up with this idea that she was going to have a record that would come out, and then also an animated series that would go along with it. But the company went out of business.
Yeah, for some reason it petered out.
Yeah.
I imagine it was cocaine related. Yeah.
Never mind.
Yeah.
Because the petered out part is in coke.
Oh.
Is,
oh,
that's...
We got kids here.
That's why I didn't explain it. Yeah, I just alluded. Yeah.
Yeah, so.
But yeah, and so the idea was thrown, you know, on the back shelf forever and then later came out. And so if that's why if Dazzler seemed a little dated even then, that's why.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an awesome story.
Back to you, moderator. Gotcha. Back to you.
So, now we're out to indie comics. Like I said, nowadays it's a lot easier to get an indie comic out because you have the desktop publishing tools.
And the internet.
Internet, companies, that conventions like this where you're not stapling the comic books together yourself. But there were a set of comics and creators that were fighting the good fight back in the 70s, trying to do things other than... wanted to tell stories without actually having to go work for one of the big two, right? So some of the big comic books out of this one was Captain Canuck. Someone want to talk about Captain Canuck for a little bit?
Where's he from? I'm really confused. I mean, I feel like there's a message here. I can't decipher it. Someone crack the code.
Essentially, you've got the Captain America of Canada.
Canada?
Yeah.
Now I get it.
But there's a I'm leading you into a connection here. There's a connection that might be interesting for locals about him.
Was created by a Mormon.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, the Captain Canuck was created by a Mormon.
You can blame the Mormons.
Yeah. And so I think he has a new series out.
He does
now.
Right now. Yeah. IDW, I think.
Yeah, IDW puts it out.
And the character has gone through a
little change. But
some licensing struggles as to who owned and could publish.
Turns out it's Canada owns Captain Canuck.
Right. Yeah. But he actually, if you look, there's a website that'll tell you what they think every character's religion is.
And they're wrong.
That is hilarious, yeah.
I mean, well, so we talked about this on one of our other panels, that because they went to this webpage, they assumed that Doug Ramsey was Mormon because he's a blonde kid from upstate New York that can translate languages. So... And buddy. So, but that was easily debunked because he had a very Protestant funeral.
Ah, so, gotcha.
Yeah.
So, and then American Splendor had a movie just recently, or not recently.
Yeah, it was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
10 years ago. Just recently.
Raise your hand if you saw American Splendor. Great film, by the way.
Yeah, on HBO film.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Stars Paul Giamatti and Judah Friedlander and Harvey Pekar, in it.
Yeah,
he plays himself.
The creator, Harvey Pekar.
Yeah. You want to talk about Pekar?
Yeah, Pekar's a really interesting guy. He very anti-establishment as far as comic book publishing goes.
Yeah, he worked for the government though.
Right. Yeah, this is where you start to see more self-deprecating humor in comics, but also very sad at the same time. Obviously, for adults, could never be marketed to. Well, I mean, could be purchased by children, but never marketed to children in that way.
Yeah, it's his comics showed a depressing slice of life look in inner city Cleveland. And if that sounds exciting to you, I suggest Howard the Duck. The, also takes place in inner city Cleveland. But it's it follows this misanthropic person, and he Harvey put into his comics all of his shame and all of his despair, and it was drawn by comic greats of the era, Val Mayerik and Robert Crumb, and it was just fantastic. And it almost makes you feel good, like, well, at least I don't have it as bad as Harvey. Well,
and if you get on YouTube, there are some interesting interviews.
Yeah, he used to go on David Letterman.
Exactly,
And he finally even alienated David Letterman by having a big anti-establishment rant on there.
It's worth watching and bizarre.
Yeah, and so if you like bizarre comics, kind of slice of life comics, or even if you're a fan of the 70s, it's, you get to see the way the culture actually was, because so much you look back and it's all disco or it's all Bowie and stuff, and it's not as real. And if you read this stuff, you get to see a real look at what life was like in Cleveland back then.
I actually like the all Bowie version of the 70s much better than the reality, so I don't want to read it.
Yeah,
cool. So Josh, tell us about Cerebus and Dave Sim and how that came about.
So Dave Sim, first of all, it was really strange working in a comic book shop and seeing comics that were not, in fact, you know, Marvel or DC, and yet people were buying them, because that wasn't typically the case necessarily. And so here was Cerebus that was totally mocking a lot of contemporary literature, Elric of Melniboné and a bunch of other things like that. But the real reason that I was so interested in this guy is because I wanted to make comic books. Every comic book I sold, I thought, and I read almost everything that came through the store, and I kept thinking to myself, that's a lame story. Because, I mean, I apologize, but in the 90s, 4 out of 5 of them were kind of lame. And I thought,
Five out of five.
I thought I could do that better, but where is an example of someone that's done that? There's an example. This guy did 300 issues of Cerebus, and in that time, he ran the gamut from really satirical stuff to really serious to really dark to totally insane to alienating everyone else that he worked with, but he did it, you know, more or less by himself, and he was really successful. I think his biggest comic, and I know these guys are going to know the exact number, but like 37,000 issues for issue 100, I think.
That sounds right.
Okay, I had to fact check myself. Yeah. But I bring this because this is ultimately what I think helped create this. These independent comics that are like proliferated out there on the vendor floor. This guy really helped kind of spearhead that entire effort. And I love the indie stuff. I also liked heavy metal growing up in that time frame.
Yeah, we got a slide for this.
Oh, good. You know what?
But no, I want to talk about Cerberus some more. So,
the Earth Pig Born.
Yeah, so what it in the... they're sold in these big phone books. You see this? They're fantastic. And they're not terribly expensive. They're like $20 a piece. And you got a week worth of reading. And so the first Cerberus trade, he's like Conan the Barbarian. And he goes about and does his Conan things. In the second story, he finds himself into a large city, and the story's called High Society, and he takes over the government. And you've gone from barbarian story to political satire and political intrigue and things like that. In the next story, he takes over the church.
Becomes the Pope.
Yeah, he becomes the Pope.
Seriously, we can't make this stuff up.
Yeah, and it's fantastic. And if you don't mind a poke at religion a little bit, it's a great read. I recommend it. And it's all fantastic. Near the end, it gets a little politically incorrect, but...
At some point, so this guy, and I don't want to derail the con too much with this, but at some point, this guy was smoking pot like a crazy person, right? And at some point, he did so much LSD that he ended up hospitalized. And in this fever dream of drugs, he basically said, 300 issues. And he was so dead set on this number. Again, I'm looking for some fact checks from the guys who actually know stuff. But he was so dead set on this number that he said that if I die before this comic is complete, before 300 issues are out, then I want you to print blank pages up until we complete the entire series. And I luckily he didn't die, or maybe unluckily he didn't die, but it ended at such a fizzle.
Yeah, angry, misogynistic.
Oh, yeah, stuff. Yeah. At one point there was a story about, like, and he called it anti-feminism, but it was really pretty misogynistic. So the guy was a nut. He's not a good example of a human, but indie comics.
It's a great comic. Yeah.
Indie comics. So.
Death of the artist, right? Right. Look at the work, not the guy. Yeah. Anyway, you had a good segue into heavy metal. Very famous magazine, started in the 70s. Tell us about heavy metal.
It was originally called Howling Metal because I think it was French or
Metal Hurlant.
Yeah, Metal Hurlant.
Yeah.
I tried to make it really French for you. You're welcome. Yeah. But so someone, the guy who did another pretty important book, was overseas and saw this Metal Hurlant, and he said, I want that for America. And so he brought it back, and they developed it, and then there's more interesting stuff that's factual. Right. Hit it.
All right, so raise your hand if you saw the movie Heavy Metal. Wow. Good guys. You got it. All right, fantastic.
And the sequel?
Yeah, that's more like it. Yeah, so the heavy metal was adult science fiction, and it was done by, and it had a real European aesthetic to it. But it also premiered fantastic American artists. Bernie Wrightson, again, did Captain Stern for heavy metal. Do you guys remember the Captain Stern story in the movie? He was that amoral Han Solo-like character.
Yeah, it's essentially Zap Brannigan.
Yeah, it's like he's like Zap Brannigan.
No, yeah, he like it is.
But more sinister.
Oh yeah.
He's this just amoral space captain that goes on adventures. But there's also it featured the art of Mobius. Do you guys know who he is? Fantastic French artist.
Yeah, the living vampire.
Yeah, no. Also a product of the 70s.
Did you feel them pull back on that one? Did it get hot in here?
We check people for rotten fruit at the door, and lucky for us, because you, sir, would be pelted.
Okay. Sorry, Mobius.
So because of the popularity of heavy metal, Marvel got into the black and white magazine game, and they published a Tomb of Dracula series and Marvel Preview and Bizarre Adventures and all these great, and it was meant for a more mature audience, and you couldn't just get these at the corner store.
There was nudity, there was sex.
Yeah, it was more adult stories, and it had smaller distribution, so they're kind of hard to find nowadays. But a lot of very popular characters now first premiered in those black and white magazines.
If you're looking for heavy metal, come to my bathroom. There's like an issue in every bathroom of my house.
I don't want to go to your bathroom.
Go to my bathroom.
But so, for example, in these Marvel black and white magazines, Star-Lord, Rocket Raccoon, who else? The Satana all first appeared in these black and white magazines, and they would go on to have a life outside of them.
Yeah, cool. What kind of questions do we have? We have like literally like the living legends.
Let's find
here
out if
have...
the mic works.
Yeah,
you have to turn it on. I think.
Oh
it does work. Hey.
What was the third most popular at the time besides Marvel and DC? Is there a third runner?
Archie probably.
Yeah. Dell Comics maybe.
Aardvark Anaheim.
Or Charlton maybe even was gone. That is actually something to talk about. Is there were a lot of companies that went out of business in the 70s, also that rose and fell quickly. If you look at like Atlas Comics, not the Atlas that Marvel owned, Timely Origin, but it was started by Martin Goodman. And his whole, this is seeing what had been going on in Marvel with creator rights. He wanted to start a new comic book publisher who would then give rights to the characters for the creators. And so you had you brought in some big names, but at the time distribution was almost a pay-to-play model, right? So if you wanted your comic book to be distributed through the warehouse, you had to be paying your dues to the warehouse to get it out. I mean, there's some well-documented cases that there were, you know, stacks and stacks and stacks of these Atlas comics that never left the warehouse because they just didn't have the money to grease the wheels to get them out. And so it came out, I think it launched in 74 and ended in 75 or 76. And so really those were your main players, which is also what kind of led to this underground comics idea. Through Robert Crumb and others.
Yeah.
But I wish we would have talked a little bit more about underground comics because there were some really cool ones.
Oh, let's talk about it right now.
Well, we got questions.
Just a quick question. I can use it for Jack.
And we're about at 5 minutes, so go ahead.
Oh.
I grew up reading comics in the 70s as an escape from what was going on in Mexico.
Right.
That was my getaway. And then at the end, you know, in the 80s, it started to turn dark, X-Men was one. It started to bring in relapse reality. I wonder what you guys think about the comics that are an escapism for the next, especially the teen young adult market. And the ones that are still dark, they almost celebrate the dark side of life. For me personally, I feel like the comics helped me more deal with reality by being an escape than the ones now that almost wallow in what you're living through anyway as a teen. I miss kind of that escapism.
So that's a really great point, and I'll let experts talk about the meat of that. But I will say that nowadays, because of how easy it is to self-publish and because of how many comics are out there, you can find exactly what you're looking for. And if you want a specific type of escape, not just escaping, but a specific type of escape, it's out there. So, yeah, I agree that some of that it has happened, but I think we've gone full circle, and you can find anything you want. But to her point.
Yeah, I think there were many, many of people reading comics who enjoyed that part during the 70s, and luckily they've been able to go on creating comics in that same niche. I would think Mike Allred and Mad Men would almost be like a continuation, or at least heavily influenced by more of that whimsical, fun...
Flaming Carrot, is that what you're talking
about? Yeah, like, yeah,
that sort
like
of stuff.
Coming out of that, you know what I mean? So I don't think your experience was solely unique. I think a lot of people went through that. Comics is a business, and when Killing Joke comes out and sells so much because it was so dark and messed up, like that's, you now created a more profitable model, right? But I think that that's not a unique experience. I think there are a lot of people that do that, and luckily has inspired a lot of other different comics because of that.
Yeah, I have a friend that only really prefers reading these older comics because the escapism is real. Life is depressing enough. I don't need to read League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and get more depressed by it, you know? And so she almost exclusively buys Superman comics from the 60s because they're so upbeat and silly. And so it's just it's that pure escapism like you're talking about. But like everyone said, that those comics exist again, and you can find that escapism, and you can escape into a fun into the world of Zeta the Space Girl,
right,
or Gronk, or any of these other fun, upbeat books. And if you ever need help finding one of those books, you can come see me at Dr. Volt's Comics. So,
I was gonna say, this is
with nice plug, nice plug.
And it's
and
subtle,
with,
right?
And with that, like, it's funny because I just realized what I've been doing. I read comics before I go to bed every night, and I don't read anything modern because I think about it too much. No, really, like, and I can't really fall asleep. But I mean, if I can pick up some Heroes for Hire or some original Guardians of the Galaxy stuff, and that read that when I'm going to bed, it actually is a lot easier to fall asleep.
That's awesome. Okay, everybody, we're out of time for this panel. I'd like to get a big round of applause for our awesome panelists.
Oh, thank you.
Like I said, come visit. You'll see most of us on the floor or at White 28 on the Artist Alley. Come see the Salt City Strangers, and let's keep this conversation going on Twitter. These are three of our Twitter handles, so make sure that you follow us and have a great time at Salt Lake Comic Con.
Woot! That's the spirit. Whoever whistled makes me feel alive.
You? Thanks, Brett.
There you go, folks. Another episode of Death Ray Comics. Episode 4. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you didn't, maybe you just can put it on and fall asleep. It's like an old comic book. Oh, man. I will tell you one thing, going back and editing this. Folks, if you are ever at a Comic-Con and you ask a question, please, for the love of all the destruction of Galactus in the universe, talk into the microphone. They have them there. It's not just for the audience to hear you or the panelists to hear you, but for people that might be listening after it's recorded. Yeah. Our theme music this week is by the Red Hot Grind Show. It's an album, it's a novel, and so much more. Find out what it's all about at the redhotgrindshow.com. As I said, we're going to have a lot of new interviews coming up in the near future, so sit tight. But until then, keep your nose in a comic book.
Understood by jazz musicians, hipsters, beatniks, juvenile delinquents, and the criminal fringe.
You have been listening
to another podcast
brought to you by
Death
Ray Media.
Scroggle!